Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's February 3rd. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Adam Carroll. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning. And we had a pretty warm start to the day, though. We were in the low 40s for a while here across Park City, but that front came in and it has dropped those temperatures right back down so the snow could start flying here across Park City. And we'll pick up a few inches of snow here throughout the day today. Of course, mountains will pick up several more than that by the time everything's said and done. But this is the heaviest portion of the storm in terms of the precipitation as the cold front continues to track southward through the state, but bring in that colder air and usher in that colder air as the winds shift from a south flow to a northwest flow for the remainder of the day. So we've already hit our high, and we'll drop back into the low 30s here for the majority of the rest of the day. We'll have some lingering mountain snow showers tomorrow through the day as well. After a much colder start in the low teens, we'll be only in the upper 20s tomorrow. And then we have another weak storm coming in on Friday that will bring another bout of accumulating snowfall to Park City as temperatures hover around the 30-degree mark. And then we dry out for several days. We'll start gradually warming up into the mid to upper 30s as well as we dry out for your weekend. But it does look pretty nice over this upcoming weekend in Park City. And we look forward to additional storms coming in next week. But for now, we've got a 1-2 punch over the next couple of days, and this is exactly what we need.
Yep, sure is. Thank you. And with a look in the backcountry, on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, it's Trent. Good morning, Trent.
Hey, good morning, everyone. We're psyched to see that it's snowing up there in Park City. And, I think the storm will do well for us. I think you could see 6 to 12 inches up there on the Park City ridgeline, through tomorrow, by tomorrow afternoon. The National Weather Service has issued a winter weather advisory until 3 p.m. on Thursday. It has been a very active week over the past 8 days. We've had a total of 51 avalanches reported to the Utah Avalanche Center. And unfortunately, as most of you probably have already heard, on Saturday, a 57-year-old skier, Kurt Damschroeder, a local man there in Park City, was killed in the backcountry off Square Top. The Utah Avalanche Center has posted the final accident report, and you can find it on our website at utahavalanchecenter.org. And, really, I was there personally, and, our thoughts definitely go out to the ones that are affected by this tragic accident, especially the family and friends of Kurt. So stay strong, and we're definitely a little saddened by this accident. Moving forward, it's just not going to go anywhere. Unfortunately, like we've been saying over and over this winter, it's going to be a dangerous one. We still have very weak snow scattered throughout the range, mainly on the slopes that were shaded. So those could be west through east facing slopes at the mid and upper elevations where we harbor weak faceted snow. Winds from the past 24 hours, as well as today's new snow, will increase the likelihood of triggering a deep and dangerous slab avalanche today. Signs of instability, something like cracking or collapsing, it just might not be present today. And even if you see tracks on a slope, it's in no way does it mean it's safe out there. All you really have to do is find the right spot on the slope. You'll collapse the slope. It'll shatter like a pane of glass. You'll look to your left, you'll look to your right, but there will be nowhere to run. The avalanche you just triggered will likely be 2 to 5 feet or deeper and hundreds of feet wide and likely unsurvivable. So the best thing we can do is avoid this altogether. That either means, staying out of the backcountry, and or if you are going to go in the backcountry, make sure you're on slopes that are under 30 degrees in steepness with nothing steep above or adjacent to you. And today, the overall avalanche danger is high on those upper elevations, especially the steep slopes facing northwest, north, northeast, and east, and traveling in avalanche terrain is not recommended.
Hey, I wanted to ask you, I know that the gates there at the top of 9990 were closed so that the resort and I think Utah Avalanche Center could get up there and complete the investigation. What do you know about, because we're hearing that the gates remain closed. Is that the case?
Yes, and when we were there on Saturday, the gate was closed due to the avalanche recovery of Kurt's body. So they, you know, Park City Mountain Resort, along with Summit County Sheriff and the Department of Transportation, they deemed that area completely unsafe and closed it. But the following day, the closure was ordered, I believe, through Park City Mountain Resort. And I think they're going to have a meeting with the Forest Service. As far as the Utah Avalanche Center is concerned, we are not really taking part in this. I do believe the gate is closed today. I think it's just waiting on a meeting that was supposed to happen on Thursday between the Forest Service and Park City Mountain Resort. So I suppose stay tuned. I'm sure it's pretty big news for a lot of us. And hopefully they'll get something out and let us know what their decisions are.
Okay. Thank you, Trent.
Thank you.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with Heber City Mayor Colleen Potter, but talking about last night's meeting there. Park City Manager Matt Dias and Deputy City Manager David Everett with a preview of this week's City Council meeting. They'll be discussing one of the items about the affordable housing as part of the Arts and Culture District. And finally, Mountain Line Association of Governments Regional Trails Planner Don Taylor with an update of the growing trail system in Wasatch County. Stay tuned. Well, the Sundance Film Festival for 2021 handed out awards last night. KPCW's Rick Bruff reports that a narrative film about a girl with hearing growing up in a deaf family was the big winner of the night. Another major winner was a U.S. documentary about a landmark 1969 concert.
The Grand Slam winner at the awards was a U.S. dramatic feature called CODA, an acronym meaning Child of Deaf Adults. Setting a record for the Sundance Festival, the film won the Audience Award, took the top prize for directing, won for Best Ensemble Cast, which included Oscar-winning actress Marley Matlin, and finally won the Grand Jury Prize. The director, Sean Hader, was ecstatic at the end of the evening.
Oh, my God!
All right!
Woo!
Yeah!
Oh, my God. I'm so excited. I'm so moved. I want to try to sign and talk at the same time, but it's hard.
Some of her collaborators conveyed their thanks to the audience by signing. One of them joked that he wasn't speechless, he was handless. In the U.S. documentary category, the film Summer of Soul looked back at a lost historical gathering, the Harlem Cultural Festival, which attracted 300,000 people the same summer as Woodstock. The film, directed by Amir Questlove Thompson, won both the Audience Award and the Grand Jury Prize. In the world cinema category, the drama Hive, about a single mother dealing with the aftermath of the war in Kosovo, won the Grand Jury Prize, the Audience Award, and a directing award for filmmaker Blurta Basholi. The Grand Jury Prize for World Documentary went to Flea, a story told in animation about a Middle Eastern refugee in Europe. The Audience Award in that program went to Writing with Fire, about female journalists in India. The awards concluded a six-day event that was conducted entirely online. The host, comedian Patton Oswalt, joked about a festival that had to adapt to a pandemic.
I really wish there was a Sundance this year, if only to watch the war between the Pfizer and Moderna suites trying to woo all the cool celebs to use their vaccine. Hey, Pfizer is 99.9% effective and comes with a Vera Wang hemp mask and a goop candle. Hey, A-listers. Come to the Moderna suite, get your vaccine, and stay for Grey Goose Jello Shots with TikTok's top influencers and guest DJ, Dr. Fauci. But let's start the show, because I have a busy evening later, because I'm, of course, hosting Slam Dance on the Wi-Fi that they'll be stealing from you.
Festival director Tabitha Jansen congratulated Sundance's staff, the filmmakers, and the audience.
So we made it. We parted on a spaceship. We looked up, we looked around, we looked at each other. The stories were told, the connections were made, and we were here together.
Sundance Festival director Tabitha Jansen. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Joining me now on the phone with an update from yesterday's Heber City Council meeting, I have Heber City Mayor Colleen Potter. Good morning, Colleen.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the official meeting time has now changed to 7 p.m. to give the council a little bit more time to dig into the work session issues before the start of the public meeting. How did that go for everyone?
Well, I think it's too soon to tell. We are hoping that we can really get into the nitty-gritty in the work meeting and make it so that the regular meeting moves quicker and people can kind of focus in on the big issues. But I think we had mixed results last night, but we'll see. We'll try it a little longer.
Okay. Let's get to the North Village Overlay Zone, or the NVOZ presentation. Councilmember Mike Johnson made a surprise presentation to the council and asked the council to consider a change to the plan. He is suggesting turning the area near Utah Valley University into commercial and affordable workforce housing, and says that single-family units shouldn't be in that zone. Then Councilmember Rachel Kaler wondering about being asked to consider another version of the NVOZ and yet another plan, especially at the 13th hour when the council had already weighed in on the existing plan. So what do we do here? I mean, the council's been talking about this for about a year, and it still seems to be pretty unsettled.
Exactly. That was my question last night, is to the council, what do you want to do? Because we've heard all the reasons why everybody doesn't like it. And, you know, we hear from the community all the time. We continue to get emails and concerns. And I think it's a difficult decision for this council, because we see that the county has given some entitlements. It's going to happen. It's like having another city on our border. But nobody wants that kind of density. And so I think we continue to try to come up with something that's palatable to everyone. And it seems to be a moving target.
So under the current plan, is there density entitlement on the east side of US 40?
Well, there were entitlements from the county, but there are different opinions about what those entitlements were. And the farthest one along in the process was that resort that the council has said they don't even want to consider as part of the annexation plan. The Highlands as well, the one that's closest to Heber, is farther along in the process. But we continue to have, because the way the county defined ERUs and the way the city has done units, there's been some differences there to try and really flesh out what exactly they were entitled to. They've also been given different amounts through the water rights. Like the JSSD has said, hey, you guys can pay this much to reserve these water rights. And sometimes that differs from what the zone was. So there's a lot of confusion around what exactly. But we feel like we've drilled it down pretty carefully. But then I hear new things. And so it's really frustrating. But I think we're getting closer.
Yeah, so going back to Councilmember Mike Johnson's plan, does it make sense to have more of a self-sustaining village with a commercial center and residential development so that we create less traffic on US 40?
It makes sense to me. I mean, a lot of planners are saying, look, if you can create some of these things so that it's more walkable and everyone isn't driving down the same road to get to the same grocery stores, it feels like less density. Most people are focused on the numbers, but there are a lot of strategies in designing development that can create it so that people are more, you know, using services within their area and not creating such an impact on the whole city. So theoretically, it makes sense. Just whether three council members will agree to it is the question.
Yeah. Councilmember Heidi Franco weighed in on the urban parks and gathering areas and said that the amenities don't seem to be part of the plans. Is that correct?
Well, we have this master plan for the county, and then we sort of drilled down on our own plan, and she just wanted to make sure that we're connecting everything and it's in the ordinance. And so, yeah, I think that'll be a simple change, and I'm sure the council will all agree to it.
All right, so are we coming back to a work session on this again before taking a vote?
It's looking like it, yeah.
All right, several items on the work agenda last night. Jordanelle Village 2 is part of the Sorensen annexation. Developers provided the council with a concept plan approved for almost 5,800 units. This phase they're talking about just for 600?
Yeah, they've divided it into pods, they're calling it. So if you look at the whole annexation, you can see all these different little pods. So this is just the very first little area that they're developing, and it's closest to the city.
Yeah. Some questions were raised by Councilmember Ryan Stack about the open space calculations. So do we have what we're supposed to have in terms of open space?
Yes, I believe so. I think he was saying, do we count the area that's outside? But in the staff report, they talk about 30% open space within that area, and then there's like another 80 acres surrounding it. But as far as I know, they have met the requirement.
Councilmember Rachel Kaler had mentioned that her constituents are mostly worried about trails, and she said that the homes will displace the lower zigzag part of the trail here. Do we know how much of the lower trail will be eliminated?
I don't know yet. I do know that in the master development agreement, they're allowed to move trails, but not to limit or reduce the total amount of trails. So we have not seen exactly what that will look like. I know there have been a lot of concerns about the trails, but Sorensen spent a lot of money on putting those in, and they recognize the value to the development. And so I've not heard of anything that would limit the trails that we have. It may shift it. It may, you know, move that lower section over, but I'm certain that we will have as many trails as we have now or more.
Okay. Rachel Kaler also mentioned she's concerned about the safety of Coyote Lane and the U.S. 40 intersection there, and is asking for a traffic light sooner than later. So how likely is it that UDOT would find that intersection is eligible for a traffic signal?
Well, we know that there's one it's planned, but they have to reach a certain standard as far as the number of traffic and the number of, you know, people coming out of the development on US 40. I don't know what those numbers are, but we intend to talk to them and see, you know, what they need. I don't know that it will happen before. I mean, I don't think there's anybody even moving into either development up there, the Ivory or the Sorensen, for at least a year. And so maybe they will do it at the beginning of that, but we haven't had that conversation yet, so we will certainly look into it and find out.
Is it already a trouble spot?
Well, it is tricky because when I drive out of that Coyote Lane often, and to turn left is really difficult because of the speed of the traffic and the amount of traffic. Councilmember Johnson mentioned that he's told his children they're not allowed to turn left out there. Turning right isn't as bad, but there's quite a bit of traffic on 40, so it's hard to cross over.
Yeah. Council also had a discussion with regard to the fee in lieu of, and identified that the county's $29,000 affordable housing fee doesn't come close to covering the cost of an affordable unit. According to Councilmember Johnston, a study done about 20 years ago shows that fees should be about $90,000. So are we talking about increasing that then?
Well, the city has already increased ours, and that's why this came to the council, because there was some discrepancy and some, you know, some concern that developers are sort of playing the city against the county, because we had back years ago, they would say that it was easier in the city, and now the argument is, well, it's cheaper in the county, and urban development belongs in a city. And we have gone to the Housing Authority recently and said, we need to have a countywide plan. We all need to be on the same page. And that's kind of what we were moving toward. But it looks like the council wants to leave it where it is and encourage the county to increase their number.
So what is the city's at then?
Well, ours is a percentage of the total development. So one of the developments that was on the agenda last night, the last item on the agenda, Turner Mill, theirs was going to come in at over $1 million. And the idea was that it was 6% of the value of the entire development, which, you know, depending on the development, depending on the value, it came in at a much higher number. So it would be closer to that $80,000 number that Mike had referred to, 80 or 90. And there was also an argument that, you know, on a big house, 28,000 isn't a very big number, but on a small house, that's a lot bigger number. So that's why the city moved to a percentage. But I think this will be coming back again to the council, because, you know, there wasn't really a certain clear direction.
Okay, so, I mean, who reaches out to the county to ask them to look at increasing theirs?
I think that Mike will bring up that conversation in the County Housing Authority Board. He's on that board.
Okay. And finally, I wanted to mention that a budget amendment was voted on, the third one for the 2020-21 fiscal year budget due to unexpected expenditures. How much of a change are we talking about?
Oh, goodness. I've got to pull it up because I have so many numbers in my head right now. It's not. It wasn't a big number. There were some staffing needs that had been approved previously, and then when COVID hit, we kind of froze everything. And so some of these were just to finish out the year, like, for example, a staff support in the police department. We're only looking at $31,000 to finish out the year for an administrative assistant. Let's see, another one for 44, and then an engineer at the, just to, you know, and it comes out of different departments because for the engineer.
Right.
So, I'm sorry, I don't have the total number in front of me.
So are the revenues, though, coming in better than you had anticipated?
They are. You know, when we first, COVID first hit, we just sort of stopped all capital expenditures and froze anything. And the first month, we came in at like 95% sales tax revenues from the previous year. But every month since then, we've beat our sales tax revenues for the previous year and even had a month recently that was 120% of the previous year. So we have been really surprised at how strong our sales tax revenues have continued throughout this pandemic.
Okay. Hey, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, that's all for right now. Just lots going on, and each meeting is full of new things. So thank you for the opportunity to share them.
All right, Colleen Potter, thank you. Park City Council meets tomorrow, starting in work session at 2:30. On the phone with a preview, Park City Manager Matt Dias, along with Deputy City Manager David Everett. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
Matt, first up in work session, the annual library staff update. Any idea when the library is going to reopen?
Well, it will be dependent, obviously, on our response to the COVID regulations that we have in place. But I think, you know, our intent is to provide a new level of certainty. So during our work session tomorrow, staff will be coming in with a benchmark system. So depending on the infection rates in the community, the transmittal rates of COVID-19, that will warrant sort of different levels of library services that will be predictable to the public. We've obviously felt the pain of having to turn certain customers away. We know that our library has become our community living room, and a lot of people rely upon it for internet service and other types of school after hours, homework, meeting rooms. And so, we'd love to be able to bring the facility back on board, and I think we're committed to making a predictable path forward for the public, dependent upon what happens with COVID-19.
Now, the fiscal year 2020 report in the packet does not compare the numbers to fiscal year 2019. So do we know how well we did? I mean, there was no comparison. It was just, a number.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think they're going to be prepared to share that tomorrow. They're still working on compiling those numbers. So, I obviously haven't seen them myself. My expectation is that they'll be obviously down in some areas, obviously the in-person visitation, utilization of meeting rooms, but there'll be huge increases in other areas in terms of our online participation, online programming. We're doing curbside book checkout, and we've done a lot with the sort of audio and visual arts this year in terms of renting movies and having podcasts. And so it'll be a very interesting report.
All right. Let's see. At 3:15, David, another discussion on the housing for the Arts and Culture District. What do you hope to get from the council in this 2.5-hour discussion?
Well, once again, we're reviewing a specific element of the Arts and Culture District project as proposed. At this time, the council is going to really dig into the housing piece. We talked about transportation at the last meeting, and housing is really the big one to tackle now. And I think at the end of the day, we don't have an expectation that the council is going to make a firm decision at all, but really just hope to flesh out the last of their questions and concerns about the affordable housing component of the project, which, we all acknowledge it's an expensive piece of the project, but it's also a vital piece to the to the project working well in terms of, you know, vitality and sort of a 24/7 presence of people on at the district.
Yeah, so the staff report does say that the city-funded affordable housing is a foundational element of the district. So if it's not affordable, then should it still be part of the plan, or should community housing be part of the district no matter what?
Well, that's really up to the council to decide, but as it has been proposed and planned over the last, you know, 3 to 4 years, it's always had a significant housing, an affordable housing component. And by affordable, we mean affordable to the people who would be renting the units. The, you know, the cost per square foot or per unit to build is expensive, but regardless of what happened there, the expectation has always been that it would be an affordable unit for people to actually inhabit.
Yeah. And what we're hearing is that the costs are more expensive than thought. I mean, we've seen construction costs go up by 20%. We've got underground parking as part of this. There are elements to go to net zero. We've got contaminated soils to mitigate. How do you reduce the costs? Or can you?
Yeah, I mean, there are some things that the council could decide to do in terms of building materials and some of those other components you mentioned. There are ways to reduce those costs. The underground parking piece of it is an interesting one to talk about, because regardless, underground parking is planned to happen on site. And part of how we've calculated paying for it is to take a proportional amount associated with the affordable housing in terms of the funds available and have those contribute to the parking construction costs. But that doesn't have to be the case. The council can decide if they want that the affordable housing funds don't necessarily need to go to helping fund the parking component. So it's a little bit of a take money from here and use it there or don't kind of decision that gets to be made in part. But at the end of the day, this is a tough site. I mean, it's a phenomenal site. It's really an ideal site in terms of location for this kind of development, for a mixed-use development, for an arts and culture district. But it comes with a singular set of challenges when you're talking about, you know, an infill development where you want to maximize the surface land use so that it's not being taken up by things like parking for cars, you know. And so, you know, those things add up. Those things cost money to do that kind of development, I think, in a way that is, you know, to meet the standards and expectations of the residents of Park City. And so those things, it's a totally different ballgame from trying to develop, say, out at, you know, Quinns Junction or even Kimball Junction now. It's just, you have different challenges and they cost money to address.
Yeah. And the staff reports notes that looking at ways to lower the cost, you could reconfigure the layout and also look at taller structures. But Matt was certainly around. I mean, that was pretty much the promise when we purchased this property, that it would remain within the parameters of the zone. So are we talking about asking for a height exception?
Well, again, I think as a staff, our job is to bring council options. We're not necessarily recommending any sort of significant height exception. I do think there are ways to change the layout within the sort of the parameters of the box for that one building, for the building that has the majority of the housing in it, to make it sort of a more efficient use of space so that there's more shared walls, there's less corridors within the building. The trade-off there, though, is in order to make that work, we would need to reduce the surface. There were initially some surface level parking spaces that were incorporated into the building, and then there were housing units on top of that. So to really bring down the cost associated with the housing there, you'd need to remove those surface level parking spaces and put housing units in that location instead. So that's, again, it's a trade-off worth considering.
Yeah. So if you included market rate housing, is that going to help lower the costs?
It would not help lower the cost per square foot to construct these units, no. What it would do is provide more funds for moving forward the next housing project in the city's pipeline. So it doesn't help you with your per square foot cost or your construction cost per se, but it does provide more revenue in some ways for the projects moving forward in the housing pipeline. However, the trade-off being that, you know, initially you're getting less affordable units built in that time frame that we're looking at building.
So as part of that, we'd mentioned the contaminated soils mitigation. Do we have that toxic fill repository ready to go off of 248 there?
Well, I want to be clear. It's not. It is a repository that the city is constructing specifically to use for this project, and maybe some room for a couple of other future city projects if needed. So we're working on getting that entitled right now and planned out. So it's moving forward for sure, but it's going to be a very relatively small scale facility, and again, I would also emphasize that it's not a temporary facility, but it's a relatively short-term facility, so a 5 to 10 year repository. And yes, we are making progress on that and seeing that happen out at the Gordo site.
So does the EPA then give the entitlement for that? Or the state?
The state does, and the EPA basically grants the state the authority to do that.
All right. And then your report also also mentions that you're looking for partnerships to help build this affordable housing. I guess this is unaffordable housing. I don't know how to talk about it. But
it's expensive affordable housing.
Expensive affordable housing. So give me an idea who these partners might be, and do you have any interest?
Well, we're pretty far along in this process with this development per se, with this specific housing initiative, I guess you could say. So, the city certainly is interested in figuring out ways to partner with the public, with the private sector on housing projects moving forward, but I'm not totally sure that it would work to bring someone in at this point, other than in the terms of when it comes time to manage and operate housing units. That's probably not the business the city will be in. And so we'd certainly partner with private sector companies to make sure that the operations worked. But in terms of, designing and building, we're pretty far along, and the city thus far hasn't, we're not looking at necessarily selling off or transferring ownership of the housing component of the project.
All right. Before I move on, anything else you wanted to mention about today, tomorrow's discussion?
No, I'd say at the end of the day, it's all about balancing priorities. And while the Arts and Culture District certainly checks a lot of boxes in terms of the city's priorities, those priorities don't come without cost. And so council's got some challenging and hard decisions to make around how to balance those priorities. And we'll be talking about those in depth tomorrow.
Okay. Matt, you will also get another budget update. When we have some sales tax updates, looks like we were below for July and August, but up September, October, and way up for November, like 21% than originally budgeted, not based on the cuts that were made for the COVID. So, I mean, it sounds like we could be at a wash. Any idea what's coming for the Christmas holidays? And do we have a big hit for January as well?
Well, I wish there wasn't such a long lag in the reporting from the state of Utah. Unfortunately, we wait a minimum of about 2 months until we find out our sales tax numbers. And as you've alluded to, November exceeded everyone's expectations. And we had a very strong summer and fall. But I am, while we're optimistic, I want to just add a dose of caution in that, The four biggest months for the municipality are December, January, February, and March. And so we don't want to have sort of a false positive on our recovery or our ability to remain stable in the midst of the pandemic. So we will be eagerly awaiting next month's report. I think, to your point, December will be a big tell for what the winter might look like. We are worried about the lodging industry, though, in particular. We think that's one of the industries that may be the hardest hit as a result. But we're, optimistic that visitation has been strong. And, clearly Main Street has been a busy place, and the sales taxes thus far have sustained us.
Okay, so this cautious optimism, I suppose. Let's talk a little bit about a recreation update. Again, not nearly as bleak, I think, as expected. Tennis on pace for a record revenue year. You have seen some savings due to less staff because we haven't had a lot of in-person classes. So, I mean, what's the outlook here? Far enough in the hole that we're going to need to increase fees once we recover? Or
No, I think, you know, the message here is much like the library update. You know, despite unprecedented challenges, we have found a way to be adaptive, flexible. Staff has put in an incredible amount of work to open the facility at different levels throughout time, both protecting the public and protecting staff. We were able to offer a myriad of camps and clinics, most of our youth programming and senior programming throughout the year, clearly with different precautionary measures, sometimes in a facility, sometimes outside of a facility. And then the two bright spots, you know, obviously were tennis and pickleball. Those lent themselves early on to social distancing activities, and those are having their best year ever. But I think we found a way. We've been adaptive, we've been flexible, and very, very proactive about protecting our staff and the public. We know that this is a beloved community service, much like the library. You know, when you go to the Mark, you see your friends, you see your family, you see your neighbors. And so we're doing everything we can to support these very, very important services.
The council is being asked to access later on $170,000 of emergency contingency funding. What's that for?
Well, you know, recently we've been aware that there are some emergency or immediate needs in Park City. So despite the optimism or the cautious optimism about our sales tax, which is, you know, but one indicator of community health, there are many other indicators that are perhaps even far more important. And we think there are some immediate needs in terms of additional support for vaccine distribution and rapid testing, mental health services, food security and distribution programs, and then rental assistance and eviction support programs. And so we heard there's a need out there. We obviously have lots of our council members as liaisons to local nonprofits and boards and commissions. And there's sort of two ways that we can proceed. And one is that we have these emergency funds available and they can be allocated immediately, and staff will be able to administer those allocations and then report back to City Council. Or we can conduct some type of a request for proposal process. And, you know, instead of letting this draw out, given these emergency needs, we felt compelled to bring this to council right away and get their decision about, is this something we need to act on imminently, or can we wait a few weeks to put out a request for proposal? So that will ultimately be, you know, a discussion that council will talk about tomorrow evening, and then we will be prepared to act fast.
All right. Council will also get a social equity quarterly update. Park City has scored low on the Human Rights Campaign Municipal Equity Index over the last couple of years, earning 35 out of 100 in 2019 and then 37 out of 100 in 2020. You're looking for direction on the next steps for the LGBTQ task force. To do what specifically?
Well, I think just to take a step back, you know, we've been participating in this index for a number of years, and you know, we felt confident that we had been making incremental progress over time. This past year, you know, I don't want to sound like a sore loser or sour grapes, but we didn't score well despite, you know, several changes that the municipality made. So we do have concerns with the administration of our application, of its scoring, and we've been unable to reach anyone at the HRC and try to, you know, discuss what we, you know, perceive as sort of mistakes in the scoring of our application. But instead of focusing on that, we'd rather focus on the work that we had ahead of us, and we think that this is, you know, one important tool in the tool chest. And, you know, so we'll have the discussion with council about our application, about where we think we fell short, about how we think, you know, what the path looks like moving forward and the opportunities, and then ensure that this is still a tool that council wants to use moving forward. We have created, though, an LGBTQ alliance throughout the community with members in our school system and Circle and Quality Utah Mountain Mediation. And so we'll be looking for a direct council liaison for that as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, are you thinking maybe just doing away with looking at that index if you can't even get an answer? Reach anybody?
Well, no, it's a fine question. I don't think we're making a recommendation to do away with it ultimately. I think if over the course of this next year, if we can't get some answers to our questions and work more collaboratively with our administrator to make sure that our scoring reflects the incremental progress that we're making as a community and as an organization, you know, then you might find staff making that type of a recommendation. But again, you know, don't want to focus on the negative. Although we have concerns, we still have a lot of work to do as an organization and as a community. And I think for the time being, we're committed to that.
Yeah. So is the index, though, even applicable to Park City? I mean, certainly most of the other places that got a rating are large urban cities.
You know, I've heard a lot of that, and that's a fair question. It's obviously easier in a larger facility to implement some of these programs and policies and resolutions. Other communities now have requirements for small businesses to have gender-neutral bathrooms, and if they don't, they have to create one. You know, clearly in a smaller town and a smaller demographic, those types of expenses are something that would be difficult, perhaps during a pandemic, to put over the top of our small business community. But, you know, notwithstanding the challenges, we think it's an okay metric, and we think it's sometimes okay to have a North Star to work towards. Social equity is a community critical priority. We think this is one of many tools in the tool chest, and so we're okay being scored. We just want that score to be accurate.
Okay. Hey, Matt, David, I need to leave it there. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
Well, at last week's interlocal meeting with Wasatch County officials, Don Taylor, who works as the regional trail planner for Mountain Land Association of Governments, gave a trail update. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Don.
Hi, Leslie.
So how many miles of trail can Wasatch County now boast of?
Well, we're actually, we just updated our master trails plan, and we just topped 400 miles in our in the county. We're up to 410.3 miles.
Wow.
That's... But it's a large county, as you're probably aware. So that's, you know, that's including Strawberry Narrows trails up by Strawberry Reservoir and a lot of Forest Service trails that are more equestrian and hiking trails. But even here in the valley, we're around 200 miles of pretty much biking, mountain biking specifically designed trails. And with all the new trails going in at Jordanelle, and you know, we've got Wasatch Mountain State Park, Jordanelle State Park, and even Deer Creek State Park all have trail systems. So it's starting to total up.
Yeah, let's talk about the new trails around the Jordanelle Reservoir. Who's building this? The developers?
Well, yes. It's kind of a combination of developers and State Park, Hideout, the county. So it's a collaborative effort. The new Sky Ridge development has just this summer put in a pretty extensive, great trail system and used Mountain Trails for their contractor to build it. And then there's the new Jordanelle Parkway Road that goes from Highway 40 and the new Mayflower Mountain Resort area clear up into Highway 248 to the north of Hideout. And it's got a nice 4-mile paved trail along that roadway. And our big project, as you're probably aware, is to try and connect that trail to the historic Union Pacific Rail Trail. It's just a short, about a mile and a half piece called the Foston Spur that goes across Richardson Flats. And if we can get that piece connected, it'll virtually connect Park City to all of the Jordanelle Reservoir and Jordanelle Basin area and all those new trails.
So do we have a trail that goes around the reservoir yet, or will that ever happen, just given that we've got a dam in the way?
Well, it'll never go clear around, just as you say, because, you know, now with Homeland Security, you can't have trails cross dams. And that whole arm up into the Rock Cliffs, appropriately named Rock Cliffs area, on that south side, it's just steep, rocky terrain that's physically impossible to put a trail in. But what we're working on right now, hoping to do a grant this summer and get this done, is the perimeter trail was never completed from Crandall Point, which is kind of by Sky Ridge and across from Deer Crest, over to the marina. And that's a crucial piece of the trail that was never built. And the reason for that is they ran into a inlet where they would have needed a very expensive bridge across some wetlands and the stream and the Jordanelle Reservoir at high water. And so it stopped there. But luckily, the developer of that new property there, Lee Burbage, worked with Doug Smith at the county planning and has put in a nice paved trail on his property up the hill a little ways that goes around that canyon. So now we can apply for a grant. The park wants to put in a new trailhead there at Crandall Point, and we can continue the trail from there on around to the marina and finally complete what can be built of that perimeter trail.
All right, so is that going to happen this summer?
We're sure hopeful. We've hired a grant writer. We're putting in a grant, and with, you know, we're getting support, obviously, from Basin Rec and Summit and Park City and the county and Heber and all the developers and the state parks. So a lot of people are putting in support letters, and it's, you know, something that should have happened when the state park went in. So we're pretty hopeful we can get that grant and move that forward.
Right.
Yeah.
I was going to say, is the perimeter trail going to be all hard surface, or will there be a lot of soft surface?
No, it's going to be a soft surface trail. As I was just talking about, it parallels the new Jordanelle Parkway with the paved trail. And Sky Ridge has put in a couple of nice public trailheads on either end of the Jordanelle Parkway. So part of that grant would be to build a soft surface trail from those public trailheads down to the perimeter trail so that, for instance, you could drive over from Heber or from Park City, park in those trailheads and ride down and connect to the perimeter trail and make that a lot more utilized, highly utilized trails. You know, when it first went in, it was, they graveled it, which made it not real conducive to mountain bike riding. But over the years, it's that gravel has slowly gotten, you know, compacted down into the dirt, and it's really quite a nice single track now, and you're, you know, riding along with the mountains to one side and the lake to the other side. So it's really a much nicer, and starting to get utilized a lot now as people are discovering it's a lot nicer ride than it used to be.
Yeah.
And then the other big part is there's a new trail head called Ross Creek Trailhead over off Highway 248 by Hideout, and there's a new trail system there that's, you know, specifically mountain bike designed and built, more flow trail that connects you to the perimeter trail there too. And so, you know, if we can link all this stuff together, get the trailheads in, and three of the four are already in, and they're also planning a new day-use shoreline beach area there at Ross Creek. So I think it's really going to develop this whole Jordanelle Reservoir area into a, you know, just a terrific area to go spend the day.
Yeah. So these, as the trails become more popular, I mean, are the trail heads, do we have enough parking there? I mean, as we've seen here in the Park City area, some of the more popular trails, there's just not enough parking.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we're hoping to work out by with the developers putting in a couple of trailheads, with the state park putting in another trailhead, and they're building a big new trailhead for that beach area at Ross Creek. It's got a lot of parking in it, and so yeah, there's going to be a lot more parking over there. And if we can get connected up to the marina, you know, you've got those huge parking lots at the marina, although it's pretty heavily used right now too. But then the Mayflower Mountain development's going to have public trailheads and parking, and with the new underpasses underneath Highway 40, it'll be easy to park at Mayflower Mountain and zip underneath 40 and connect to all this also.
Okay, this map that I have doesn't show it, but does the trail from the Ross Creek Trailhead, does it go all the way to Rock Cliff?
So that's a pretty long piece of trail. The Ross Creek trails, and looking at your map that you have, the perimeter trail is in green,
mm-hmm.
and the Ross Creek trail in blue, but where it continues on around towards Rock Cliffs, that's actually the old perimeter trail and should be in green. So that's a little misleading, the map you're looking at there. The Ross Creek trails are two loops. They ride great both directions, and like I say, have nice trailheads, and soon a new beach area
Okay.
are right there underneath Hideout.
I just have another minute here. So is the Wasatch Trails organization going to be the steward of all these trails? I mean, are they the ones that are going to be responsible for maintaining them in the future?
No, these are going to be state park trails. Or developer trails that will be maintained initially by the developer and then in the future by the HOAs probably. I think the paved trail along Jordanelle Parkway will be maintained by the county. So different people will be maintaining different areas of the trail systems.
All right. And then that connection into Richardson Flat then to the rail trail, is Mountain Trails doing that then and this summer?
Actually, we've been working with Matt Wagner at Basin Recreation, and so it'll probably be Basin Rec, although Mountain Trails and Park City and Summit County are all involved in this project. But I think that, you know, it's going to connect into the rail trail right there by Quinn's Junction, where the pavement ends presently, I believe. So, you know, it'll be just maintained just like the rail trail, hopefully.
Okay. I've got to leave it there, Don. Hey, thanks for the update.
You're welcome. Anytime, Leslie.
That's Don Taylor. He works as the regional trail planner for Mountain Land Association of Governments. This is KPCW Park City.